Hey, what's going on? It's At the Letters for Tuesday, November 2nd, or at least that's the day that it is today, as Arden here and Ben are sitting in a boardroom at the Rogers Center looking out over Lake Ontario and cars passing by on the Gardiner Expressway as we are getting ready to talk to Ross Atkins, general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. If you're a Blue Jays fan, you no doubt know who that is. Been a while since we had him on the podcast. Felt like it was a good time to get him back in, just considering how impactful this offseason could be for the Toronto Blue Jays.
100%. Thanks to Ross for making the time. It's funny because like around this time last year, the Jays were facing this big offseason. They had yet to sign Robbie Ray or Marcus Semien or George Springer. And they, of course, went on to do all those things and have the season where they finished fourth but won 91 games. Now they have stated their intention of being a better team in 2022, and they have some clear needs, a lot of areas that they have to improve on, and I mean, some absolutely incredible star players to build around. So we wanted to ask Ross about the approach to the offseason, some of their top players, guys like Vlad Jr., and what's next for the Jays.
Yeah, a good time to kind of look back on everything that's happened over the last 12 months or so with the benefit of hindsight, and then obviously cast ahead to some pretty big decisions upcoming for this organization. So without any further ado, here is Ben and my chat with Blue Jays GM Ross Atkins. Ross Atkins is with us. Thanks so much for taking the time. Process question right off the top, because as I understand it, your offseason kind of began with this questionnaire that you gave out to 30 plus people in the front office. So I assume you just get back this deluge of information. How do you kind of pare that down? Like, how do you kind of synthesize that?
You know, it's interesting. I heard that idea probably 10 to 12 years ago that another organization was doing it, probably during the process of interviewing someone from another organization, and just thought, wow, that makes so much sense to get a lot of individual thoughts before we start having group discussion. And it's across a very large group. It's not just, you know, Joe Sheehan, Charlie Montoya, and Mike Morove and I having, you know, that discussion and dialogue. And I think the survey goes to over 35 people, and I just don't know the exact number off the top of my head.
But right.
And then after, you know, reading Thinking Fast and Slow, continued education, the more you read about decision making, the more you read about groupthink, the more sense it made to me to ensure that we were thinking about all of the little things before we start making a very big decision, because things speed up. And as we know, maybe not all would agree with this, but I think the research is pretty strong that humans aren't the best at judgment. And, you know, having a process for that to gather information just makes a lot of sense.
It almost seems like what you're describing there with the survey would be like a way to get the thoughts of the group without groupthink. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, and creativity and innovation and giving everyone a voice and a chance to express something. If you put 30 people in a room and asked one question, you might get five reactions. And there might be some disagreement on a couple of the ideas, a couple of the suggestions. And what also can happen is momentum. And it can happen either way. It can happen negatively. It can happen positively. But groupthink, especially if a leader in the room is particularly opinionated on a certain front, that can really shift the momentum in a certain direction. So the innovation, the creativity, having, you know, more than 35 people have a voice has really helped us refine our process.
So how do you kind of synthesize that then and take all that information and kind of...
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. It's just synthesized. Well, we ask the questions in a way that we can get some, you know, understand where there is more conviction by asking questions a certain way and understand where there isn't much conviction, but then also allows for areas of, oh, well, only one person brought up this idea, but that doesn't mean it's not a great one. Let's talk about it. So it all comes down into several documents, some of it via, you know, that's automated, some of it that isn't, that several people in the office work on condensing it and consolidating, and then coming up with really targeted questions around the feedback that we get from the survey.
Was this the first year that you guys had done it? You've always done this. Yeah. So I guess looking back then to last off season, clearly an off season that led to a lot of deals that worked out very well for you guys, thinking about Marcus Semien, Robbie Ray, and others, of course, too. So what were some of the things in the course of last year's process, last year's survey, that led to, let's say, Semien in particular? I mean, to get a guy who hit more home runs than any second baseman in Major League history.
I think there was just a lot of sentiment from our professional scouts, from a lot of the members in our front office, that 2020 was not who Marcus Semien was in the 2019 version of him. There was a lot of indicators pointing that way, especially how he played in the playoffs. Even this year, Marcus got off to a slow start. Had that been a 60-game season, yeah, it would have been a very different year for Marcus Semien. I feel that we, because of what we had learned about his consistency as a teammate, his work ethic, the patterns with his swing, the patterns of his defense, we were betting that he was a lot closer to that 2019 version. And there was a lot of people that felt that way. You know, in the way we were constructed at the time, we were obviously a little bit more focused on center field initially. And we're very fortunate that we could get both of those players here.
Well, just thinking about it from a process perspective, I would think that with Robbie Ray, it was more of a, because that was what, days into free agency, yeah, that you made that transaction. Was there something that came out of like very early discussions in the offseason?
Well, that was like very late in the season.
Yeah.
Right. Like we weren't even done with our process by the time that we had decided to make that acquisition. I mean, given the need, given the support we have from Rogers and our ability to be agile, we started that process before anybody was really talking to any free agents, obviously. So fortunately, there was mutual interest. I think that was probably the most important thing in the equation, or the most important aspect of the equation, was the mutual desire. His interest in returning to our environment, his confidence to embrace the AL East, and you know, feeling comfort from both sides, I think is the only reason that worked out.
At what point this year did you kind of think, all right, this version of Robbie Ray that we're seeing, this is different, sustainable, like he might win the Cy Young? Probably, this is me saying this, not you, but he probably will win the Cy Young and deserves to. So I mean, at what point did that kind of sink in that is the track that he was on?
I'm not exactly sure to the date, but I want to say that we were still in Florida when I remember a particular start. It may have been against the Rays, where we needed a big start and he was unhittable for six innings, where it was just, you know, the swings that were being taken, or the swing and miss that was occurring, the, you know, very softly hit ground balls, his conviction and his confidence. As much as we can talk about process, as much as we can talk about objective analysis, the subjective side of it is also so fascinating and one of the most intriguing parts to me in the game, in that you just knew that confidence was going to carry him for some time, because that turned into more conviction in his pitches, more belief in that what his tools and weapons were more than enough to pitch against one of the better teams in the game. And he was doing it just about every turn. So it was pretty early.
His stuff's been undeniable his entire career, and obviously it clicked this year finally. I mean, what gave you guys the conviction in acquiring him that you could help him reach the potential?
I think it was the combination of him changing his arm action and before the 2020 season, and then getting back to the end of the 2020 season into the playoffs, where we saw closer to the consistency that he had in years prior. Not quite the 2017-18 version of himself, but definitely seeing the consistency and the tunneling of the fastball and slider occurring, where the effectiveness was better and the reasons to believe that it would continue to improve were in front of us because of that trajectory that we saw occurring And then things that we heard him talking about and adjustments that he, and small adjustments that he and Pete were making, that Pete's been great and we're very grateful for his contributions. Matt Bushman's been incredible and complimenting Pete Walker. And you know, I think the three of them really had good synergy, and we could see a trajectory that made sense to make what was not a very risky bet.
So you kind of mentioned that relationship, and that gave you guys, in a sense, a little bit of a chance to sell Robbie Ray on, if not Toronto as a city, the Blue Jays organization in 2020. And with Semien or with Springer, with any other free agent last offseason, you didn't necessarily have that base to build from because they hadn't played here before. So how do you think that that impacted things in hindsight? And I mean, obviously, at the time, you guys said, you know, we're doing the best we can. You have to make the most of the circumstances that you're in. But you know, as you look back on it, to try to sell free agents on playing in these, you know, this very uncertain territory, how much of a challenge was that?
One of the most fulfilling things about the 2020 season for me was I was reminded how much I love baseball. Not that I need to be reminded of that, but just how much joy it brings me, regardless of the circumstance. And I think a lot of players were too, because there were no fans, obviously, or very limited, and maybe in the playoffs we had them, but no fans, very different existence as they come to the field, come and go to the field, when they got back to their hotel or apartment. And once they got onto the field, even without fans, there was still that exuberance to compete. And that's what overrides and trumps almost everything. And that became a focus for Robbie in particular, and it became, you know, something that the competitive aspect of it, he knew, is the most gratifying and the most fulfilling. I don't want to speak for him, but I think we saw a lot of that across the game. And then when other players started to consider the Toronto Blue Jays and coming to Toronto / Buffalo / Dunedin, their questions around that were just more from a wanting to know what was the most likely or least likely scenario so that they could handle that from a logistics standpoint, but more focused on how competitive are you going to be?
Right.
And what are you going to do to ensure that we're competitive? And I think that overrode our uncertainty around the location.
Well, in that vein, how much do you think winning 91 games, having like the proof of concept of big seasons from Vlad, Bo, Teoscar, can kind of help you from a recruiting standpoint going forward?
I think that this is an attractive place to play. We, from the very beginning, we've said we want to be the best place to work and play in baseball. We're not there yet, but we're a lot closer. You can never know for certain, but I do believe, I have a great deal of confidence that we're not going to have to sell our situation.
When you say you're not quite there yet as far as being that best place to work and play in baseball, what are the things that you're trying to, I guess, build on?
I think the biggest thing is winning, you know, being a, you know, a year in and year out contender that everyone is not wanting to play. And we definitely took that step this year, but now we need to get deep into the playoffs and do it year in and year out. And then, you know, we'll continue to do things to the stadium. We'll continue to do things to facilities. We'll continue to think about resources and make sure that's always cutting edge, because I don't think we'll arrive there and say we're there. You're always pushing to be at another level. But, you know, I think we've made big strides.
I heard you talk a lot this year about the culture as well that you had this season in particular. And so you could see it on the broadcast every night in the dugout and just kind of the joy that you saw from a lot of players. Can you sell that when you're recruiting? Like, is that a factor?
I think that sells itself. I mean, I think, you know, Vladdy is a very natural leader because of it. It's not as common to see someone competing at the level he's competing with pretty consistent smile on his face. I mean, there's times, obviously, you see some frustration, but that exuberance and joy, I think is the perfect word, that he plays with is something that others feed off of. And I think feel some confidence from that. That is a good way to be thinking about competition and a good way for me to be thinking about something I have to do day in and day out with joy. We don't have to bring that up. I think every player in the game, every staff member in the game, every executive in the game sees that from Vladdy and others.
So you mentioned Vladdy, and you know, when you think about the last, I guess, year that he had, when, you know, 2020 season ends, he starts trying to get into really good shape and working really hard, shows up to spring training. Obviously, there's work to do in spring training and continued efforts on that front. Then plays the full season, 160 games, whatever it was, great production. That's a lot of work, basically nonstop for 12 months. So as he heads into this offseason, what do you guys as an organization, obviously in collaboration with him, what kind of plan do you set out for him?
The greatest players in the game, they, I think, do learn to work smarter and learn to work more efficiently, but usually, not in absolutely every case. I'm sure there are exceptions to everything, but usually what I've seen is that work just continues to stay on a pretty steady progression, and they learn ways to tweak it or adjust it. I would imagine that Vladdy just gets better and better on that front and learns to manage workload better and becomes even more resilient. And, you know, that's our goal for him, and that's how we talk about it, as opposed to staying where he is.
Right.
That's not our goal.
You think about Vlad, Bo, Marcus Semien, like you had a lot of everyday players. This, like, with Marcus Semien, led the league in plate appearances and games played. Like, what do you think? Even Robbie Ray, right? You think about it, went essentially pole to pole after that slip in spring training, but throwing as hard as he did. What allows you to have that kind of success from a durability standpoint this year? Because you had a pretty healthy season when you look back on
it. Yeah, I mean, outside of our bullpen, and earlier we had, you know, George Springer, obviously, but
you know, Teoscar only really missed that, you know, COVID, right?
Matsy with one COVID setback.
I feel like he had a pretty good year health wise.
It's interesting, and I will answer that, to think that three of the five best players in the American League were on our team.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of just contributions and overall production, and Marcus and Vladdy and Bo. And a big part of it is being on the field.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that there is nothing more powerful than preparing and recovering and making sure that's a part of your routine every day. They're still getting better at it, Bo and Vladdy. Marcus is very good at thinking about his day. He doesn't waver from his routine ever. And if something has to take him off of it because life happens, he finds a way to get that piece of his routine that was disrupted back into his day somehow. That's another level of discipline. He has a remarkable level.
Add in three kids and a newborn, three different cities.
he's driven. He is clearly driven and exceptionally disciplined. And, you know, most really good players that I've been around are exceptionally disciplined to their routines, that they have to have it. They have to have that. And you know, I think it's a big part of why you hear about when young players come to the major leagues, to make sure that they're respectful of not disrupting the timing of how the more veteran players preparing or getting ready. And I think the pendulum has shifted to allow for a younger player to transition better, because now younger players have better routines before they get there. And the more veteran players realize the only way to win at this game is to have also your younger prospects transitioning well. So that integration of players into new environments and cultures is more welcoming. The understanding of routines and the importance of them and trying to learn from the veteran players is something that's always talked about. And I think it's a big reason why younger players are transitioning better, is that they're being embraced.
Interesting. So, I mean, if you were to go back, like, let's say 20 years, 25 years, do you think that the collective routines in a clubhouse would now be better, stronger?
You know, I would think so, but I think they would be different. I mean, resources are different, right? We didn't have nutritionists, massage therapists. We didn't have 25 years ago, some teams didn't have strength and conditioning coaches.
Wow.
Training staffs didn't have physical therapists. You know, there was no mental skills 25 years ago. So there's different aspects that you can add to your routine, and learning how to use the different resources and tools and learning which ones are important for you, because I think sometimes you'll see a young player just try anything and everything, and that's definitely not the way to go. And so having those resources in the minor leagues is why that's so important.
Right.
So that they can learn to apply, and there are certain resources they're not going to use and certain individuals won't need.
Are you dealing with a bit of a different breed of athlete as well, though, when you're talking about really young players that you're trying? Like, Bo Bichette's a weird example because of his dad, right? Yeah. But, I mean, he was having very high-level instruction from a very young age. I'm sure that a lot of the kids you look at in drafts now have been very specialized from a very young age and know what are coming in expecting that the standards of nutrition and of conditioning and of strength are all going to be top-notch.
And no one does it better than the Dominican.
Right.
You know, you think about the number of professional baseball players that come out of an island that's roughly 9.5 million people. Maybe it's a little more than that now.
Yeah.
And makes up over 20% of Major League Baseball. And if you go watch a workout in the Dominican Republic, it's fascinating to watch and see and how structured things are, how routine oriented. It's more in a group setting than individualized for a younger population, but still something that fascinates me.
Just while we're on routines here, you know, brings me back to, I think it was 2018 or 19 when there was discussion around Vladdy and his routines and how they can improve. As you look at him now, and as you said, there's room for all players to kind of continue improving. But what contrast do you see between where he is now and where he was then?
It's just about the whole game and not as focused on offense. There's, you know, more focus on the preparation, the recovery, nutrition, strength and conditioning, defense. There's a component of base running. He is obviously someone that is very gifted. And I don't believe in just talent means you will be good. But I think he is able to do things from a just physically and visually, and then from a coordination standpoint that most aren't on a baseball field, especially with a bat in his hand. But now he's learning to use video and learning to study pitchers in a different way and not just rely on his natural ability to see so well, react so well, and then have such a dynamic and athletic swing. And that'll only continue to get better. But he's going to have to learn how to integrate that in a way that it doesn't take him away from those natural skills as well. And I think he's done an exceptional job of it. But
thinking about some of this developmental stuff and watching this World Series, I think about how well those two teams develop pitching, right? And I think in your division, Tampa Bay like develops pitching really well. Cleveland, where you guys were obviously developed a ton of really good pitching. Where do you think the Toronto Blue Jays are right now in terms of developing pitching?
We've made huge strides. We, you know, early on, we had an emphasis to thinking through from a delivery standpoint what was going to allow pitchers to be on the field and continue to grow and learn. Then we went through, after we felt like we got a handle on that, a wave of thinking about just arm strength and adding velocity where appropriate and adding potentially spin rate where appropriate. And now to refining the command, you know, starting with a foundation from a philosophical standpoint, then thinking about how we could increase power and without compromising command. And I think, the Rays and the Indians have just been a cohesive, collective group that has been together for so long, using certain tools and resources for a while, that they're seeing they've aligned the acquisition and the development. Yeah. And now you're seeing the results of that. And I think we're closing the gap on that for sure as an organization.
As far as looking ahead here, the off season is just about to get started as we record this, just kind of on the brink of the official off season. And there's this looming uncertainty with the CBA that everyone in the industry is impacted by, because it's unclear what exactly will happen by December 1st. Of course, everyone hoping for an agreement that all parties are happy with. But how does that impact things as you guys plan for this offseason?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's business as usual. Hasn't impacted us thus far. The areas where we have uncertainty, we don't feel will implicate us long term. Right? If there are rule changes that come from it, if things that are subtly different about compensation, or whether that be in the draft or just how players are compensated. So we don't feel as though, based on the direction and the guidance that we've been given, that we need to do anything differently, and we're operating business as usual. I suppose there could be a time where we have to make a decision with a little less certainty about a certain aspect of what it means long term. Could be in a contract where we may have to have just really candid conversation with the agent where we, and obviously collaboration with Major League Baseball and the union on, well, unsure about what this means for a potential extension based on the current rules and what could lie forward. So we may have to make a decision without certainty and clarity, but I think we'll be able to do that with a collaboration of Major League Baseball and the union.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that potential turbulence with players and owners is obviously front of mind globally for baseball fans. When you think about specifically Blue Jays fans, there's more so there's turbulence at the ownership level with Rogers Communications, I think is really front of mind for a lot of Blue Jays fans. As you understand it, does what's happening with the board at Rogers right now have any impact on your off season, what you can expect, what you're able to do going forward?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I feel so fortunate. I feel like I do work in one of the best places in professional sport and have incredible support from my boss, Mark Shapiro, and from Rogers. And we have always had that. And our goal has been, and we've communicated that goal to our superiors, to be the best place in work and play in baseball. And they want to see that happen. And we have felt nothing but the support from our leadership.
So as things stand now, if you and the operations group decide, hey, this is something we want to pursue with a contract, for instance, you can still do that kind of business as usual?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've had ongoing dialogue, whether that be Mark directly, there are group interactions, there's, you know, different touch points that it's been going now for 6 years where we have the ongoing exchange of information, ideas, our vision has been clearly stated, and we've felt nothing but support.
Well, it's a good position to be in considering some of the talent that's available this winter on the free agent market. I wonder if we could even just look at pitchers. I won't ask you about anybody in, you know, particular, but when I look at that starting pitching market, it's future Hall of Famers. There's guys with multiple Cy Young awards. There's frontline starters coming off of like major injuries. How would you kind of characterize this starting pitching market?
I do think there is a lot of talent available this year. I think there will also be, you know, a few more teams active this year just based on winning cycles and where things stand for different organizations. There's always going to be a certain group of teams that are involved, and we are one of them that are going to be involved. So, but the talent is exciting. The overall free agent pool is, it's fun to think about. There's a lot of different ways that I'm sure organizations are thinking about improving their team, and very glad to be in a position. If you think about where we are, our November roster of 2021 compared to our November roster of 2020,
right,
we're in a much stronger position. And albeit we have a couple of strong subtractions from that team, but they weren't on our team in 2012. Well, one of them actually was, in Robbie Ray. But we're with the, you know, the development and progress of Vladdy and Bo, with the addition of George Springer, with some of our young pitchers, bullpen and starting, that have made huge strides, feel like we're in a very strong position to tap into that pool.
Well, and when you think about those like circumstances and market factors, right, having other clubs being more, you know, last offseason, there weren't that many teams bidding aggressively for top end free agents. Whereas now you look at clubs like Detroit, Miami, they've very publicly said, we are going to be active. How does that impact your strategy and how you go about the offseason? Are you more aggressive when you know there's going to be a higher, you know, a bigger field of bidders?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting where, you know, it's hard to talk about strategy when right. you obviously...
Just lay it out for us.
The Marlins aren't listening to this, are they?
Maybe, you know, yeah, but you have to have one. Yeah. I'll tell you that. And, last year we felt as though, you know, partially, maybe you can read between the lines here by what I just offered, is that I feel like we're in a stronger position than we were a year ago. So, you know, last year we talked about, if possible, it would be ideal if we could add a player of significant impact, you know, consolidated into one player.
Right.
And didn't have to, but in an ideal world, that would have been a good outcome for us. And fortunately, we were able to do that. And in an ideal world, we'd like to do that again, but we don't have to. And I think we're in a position where it could go either way for us, where maybe there is another high impact player or two that we potentially add, and maybe not. Maybe we're in a scenario where it's four or five players that are complementing our roster. Maybe some of them aren't even everyday regular pieces, but I don't want to just roll out exactly what our first move is going to be and how we're going to approach that. But I feel that we're in a position where we have a much stronger foundation. So we have more agility at this point.
And that actually reminds me of last offseason, how it unfolded. And I just wonder what your reaction is looking back on it when you think about, all right, like you guys had added Robbie Ray and people are like, okay, the Jays have done nothing. Like this is what a, you know, this offseason is already a failure. Then you add Springer, then you add Semien. But in the meantime, there was all this like, oh, the Jays are missing, they're second place on everything. Did that reach you? Like, did you bristle at that? Like, what was your reaction as that sort of thing was unfolding?
No, I mean, that's just part of it. We recognize, one, the passion of fans and what it means to win for a fan base. And it's exciting to think about acquiring players like George Springer and Marcus Semien. And when they weren't on our team, that it's not as quite as much fun to be watching that from the sidelines. Are there times that I wish I could say, here's exactly what our strategy is and just be patient and tell them exactly what all of our exchanges have been and what our offers have been and why our confidence is high that we're going to be able to do that? That's the only reason I have frustration, is that I can't share a lot of the details and a look under the hood.
Right. And obviously, as we sit here today on November 2nd, you haven't had any of those exchanges with representation and free agents. But I assume there's probably been some discussion with other clubs just regarding what the trade market might look like and what type of values there might be out there. I mean, how have those discussions kind of progressed to this point? What are you anticipating this in the coming months?
Yeah, it has been interesting. I think teams are also very respectful that most teams are just now finishing their preparation for coming up with their strategy. And there's a couple of teams that are probably not done because they're still playing. So it's more a very general discussions that have happened about goals, about where there might be alignment or might not. And I think next week that'll start to get a lot more specific as we've all been able to prepare.
I did want to ask you about something that I've heard you say a couple times this offseason, and that's having too many of a similar style of hitter. Help me get there logically, because I think about it, you guys scored 850 runs, right?
A lot.
Third most in MLB.
Well, I mean, listen, we're fine offensively.
Yeah.
Somebody asked me the question, like, right, would you ideally like to have a more balanced? Sure. You know, it's like, I think you asked me in 2016, would you like to be more athletic and younger? Yes. Right. Like, yeah. But how do you do that? Offense is not our problem.
Right.
We do not have to score more runs. I will say this, however, we were fantastic at putting runs on the board early in games. And against really high leveraged relievers, late in games, we weren't quite as well. We didn't fare quite as well as the league did. So yeah, obviously, you know, I think we were 18th or 19th against really high leveraged relievers when they were matching up against us late in games. And, you know, I would just, if possible, like to have more opportunities to not be matched up quite as well. But in the end, right-handed or left-handed, that's not our problem.
Yeah.
You know, we obviously did not struggle to score. It's more about having different scenarios to combat the way we're being attacked, if possible.
Do you think it is possible to control when the runs are scored, though, or how they're scored?
No, I'm talking about when, you know, there's really strong bullpens that are built, especially in the AL East. You look at the Yankees and the Rays bullpens, and the way that they were able to attack our very good right-handed lineup was less than ideal. That's okay. That's not our problem.
Yeah.
But someone asked me the question, if possible, could you have more balance or maybe potentially another left-handed hitter? I'm excited about Kevin Biggio, and I know he's going to be back closer to the 19 and 20 version of himself. He didn't, with the injuries and the setbacks this year. I'm really excited about his complement. He's the solution. He's a huge part of the solution for us. It's not just the handedness. I think I talked about that as well. We're fine with aggression. You know, I love to see players that are extremely aggressive. also love it when players have 10 pitch at bats. And Vladdy's able to do both of those things. And, you know, Cavan's someone that would really complement some of our lineup sometimes based on who we're facing because of the ability to really hone in and be patient.
Yeah, if you get to 850 runs, like, does it matter how you get there?
Something's going right at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, offense isn't our problem. That is not our problem.
I feel like I've heard you and Mark say, you know, a few times now, the goal this offseason is to get better. Like, if you had a PowerPoint presentation for this offseason, it'd be titled Get Better.
Yeah.
How are you quantifying that? Like, how are you objectively sort of evaluating what better is it? We're projected to win more than 91 games.
Yeah.
What
Well, I mean, it will be based upon our goals and then our ability to execute them. And so that's where I can't just, you know, write down or tell the world exactly what our goals are. I'm sure that there's a few agents out there that would love to hear that, and probably a few other teams that would love to hear exactly what our strategy is going to be. But it'll be based on our goals and our ability to execute them. And then, yes, there are objective ways to look at that, how that complements your roster and what that means in terms of wins and losses.
And then two guys wanted to ask you about before we go. One's Nate Pearson. Is he going to be having an operation to correct the sports hernia, or what's his offseason look like?
Yeah, he's already had that procedure. I think it's 4 weeks before he's throwing again, and I think he's already into those 4 weeks. So he should be fine, should not be disrupted at all. And excited about how he finished the year, excited about him building up again, and we'll see. We'll see how spring training goes, and we'll see how the start of the year goes. But hopefully he's someone that is in extended outings and giving, whether that be AAA or the major leagues, us the impact of someone that can punch people out and you know, pitch deeper and deeper into games.
And Gunnar Hoglund was the other guy I wanted, I guess, because we never talk about him because obviously he's not pitching. But where is he at in his process?
We were so excited that he got to us. He, you know, as you learn after the fact, he almost didn't. We learned that a great deal, that there was a very good chance he wasn't going to get there. And the ball bounced the right way for us, and very excited to have added him to the organization. I think his progress has been great. He's been extremely diligent coming off of the UCL procedure. He's been in our facility almost around the clock. He lives nearby, so that's a huge benefit for us and for him. Love the person, the intelligence, his passion for pitching. A really, really phenomenal athlete that after he gets healthy, it'll be interesting. He, you know, someone that has the ability to move quickly.
Do you have an expectation for when he might be back on a mound?
Well, he'll have a pretty regular season this upcoming year.
Great.
Thanks for the time, Ross.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Arden. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. Thanks to Ross, as always, for joining us. Very kind of him to take the time. Ben, like Ross, Mark Shapiro, everybody with this organization, we've talked about it before. They will tell you what they're going to do. Like, there's not, you maybe have to read between the lines a little bit sometimes, and maybe you have to kind of translate the language sometimes, but they're pretty straightforward about their intentions and about their plans and what they want to do. And it sounds like the Blue Jays want to be very active in the free agent market this offseason, at the top end of the free agent market as well. We've seen it each of the last two offseasons, Hyunjin Ryu and George Springer. And it sounds like if Blue Jays have their way in an ideal world, they will be coming away with a player of that caliber again.
Yeah, it does seem like that's something they would like to do. And of course, Ross Atkins can't say the names Max Scherzer and Corey Seager and Carlos Correa at this point, but we can say them. And those guys are really intriguing free agents. You've got to think that if you're the Blue Jays, you're trying to get better, you're going to take a look at those players and see if there's a fit on both sides. So I think that with that being said, Ross also made it clear that it doesn't necessarily have to be that top free agent. There are other ways to do this where you add multiple free agents who can kind of help at different positions, probably maybe a little bit less splashy, but either one of those things would be pretty interesting. Might be a while though before we actually get a sense of what path this team ends up taking.
Yeah, I prefer to live in this world right now where it's all possibilities and we haven't gotten to an expired CBA just yet and a potential lockout or anything like that. But I think everything that you were just saying there just speaks to how the Blue Jays are positioned. I mean, this free agent
market is rife with talent. Like, there is a ton of impactful players here that can help a lot of teams. Sounds like there's going to be a lot more teams involved in it, which makes sense because of the amount of talent that is out there. Also, teams having made revenue in the last 12 months, I think helps. And having had fans back in the ballpark, I think helps as well. But I just think that, you know, it can be a really transformational offseason, not just for the Blue Jays, but for a lot of organizations. And look, if you're the Toronto Blue Jays and your stated goal is to get better next year, that means you need to project to win more than 91 games. Or if you want to use like run differential, you need to project to have more than a plus 183 run differential. You are going to have to make some very big moves if you are going to replace a Marcus Semien, a Robbie Ray, some of the high impact talent that's coming off of this roster, and construct a team that on opening day 2022 projects to be better than the team that finished 2021.
Man, and last year's team was really good. You know, in the end, they were a really good team. So they've got a lot of work ahead. I tend to think that it might start with some trades. It might start with some smaller scale additions and then build up gradually toward those bigger names. I do think this is going to be a slow developing offseason. So I think that, yeah, you know, probably just to set expectations. Like, if you're obviously you're listening to a baseball podcast in November, we're talking to big fans here, but I think it makes sense for fans of this sport to really expect it to go slowly. Honestly, like I don't see a world where, you know, we get to the winter meetings and there's this flurry of activity. I think it's more likely that the winter meetings don't happen.
Yeah, exactly. And you even look at the recent sample of off seasons that we have, you would expect that things are going to take a long time to develop. And then you add in CBA uncertainty and everything that's going on around the game. And like, it's very hard to see. I hate that we're having this conversation again, Ben, but it's very hard to see anything major happening, even in the calendar year of 2021.
I agree. And also look at who reps some of the top free agents, guys like Max Scherzer or Marcus Semien or Corey Seager. Oh, it's Scott Boras. And he likes to play things out pretty slowly. So, you know, with that being said, I don't think it has to be horrible that things are going slowly. I think it's just, let's just reset the expectations. This is how things work now in baseball. It goes slowly. Let's not expect November to offer much in the way of transactions, maybe some trades, and it's going to be backloaded. That's the way things are going to unfold. And I've asked a lot of people in the last couple of weeks about how they anticipate the offseason going, and almost everyone thinks it'll be slow, but no one has yet predicted that there's going to be a missed 2022 season. So I think it's just patience, just expecting that it's probably going to go slowly. Maybe that'll be frustrating to some people still, but have that expectation. It's going to be slow, but these deals will get done and there should be baseball on opening day.
And there's still very much the potential of like pretty, you know, trades involving really impactful players in the next couple of months. And I would almost expect the Blue Jays to make a pretty sizable deal at some point this offseason. When you look at how they're positioned, you look at where their needs are, and you just look at what they're trying to do. They don't have to make a trade. That's what's like interesting about this offseason is they don't have to do anything. Like, they're not in a payroll spot where they're like, oh, we can't take on a lot of near-term money. No, you absolutely can. And they're not in a spot where they're like, oh, we can't take on another really, you know, long-term contract. No, you absolutely can. And they're not in a spot where they're like, oh, we don't have really good young players that we can trade. No, you absolutely do. You can do that. So the Blue Jays can do anything. I think that the next several weeks will just be about sort of analyzing both free agent and trade markets and surveying things and evaluating them and understanding where the most optimal opportunities lie.
Right. Because it's not every team that could go out there and spend, let's say, $125 million on a free agent and also have the ability to trade Aurelvis Martinez for a controllable star player or sign someone for a two-year deal where the AAV is $25 million plus, or sign four players to, you know, more modest deals. Like, yeah, all that's on the table for the Blue Jays. Unclear where it goes at this point. Nobody even here within this building where we're sitting now, nobody here even knows. They're still figuring that out. But yeah, it'll be fun to see, and be patient.
No doubt. So our thanks to Ross Atkins for joining us this week. Our thanks to Amal Delich for doing all the work on the ground here, technically. Our thanks to you for listening. As always, he's Ben Nicholson-Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. We'll talk to you next time on At the Letters.